Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwindiger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk some more about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide you some insight and analysis and practical application that you can take back to the office in order to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
You know, the trolls that charged Axie Infinity $625 million across the bridge are now really upset because their crypto is only worth $225 million.
You know, I actually wonder if there's consequences for the people that stole that money now because it's only worth a third of what it was. Like, do the criminals have like an investment gang that's now in charge of it and is now in trouble?
Well, whatever, if they were using a laundering service, you know, imagine they turned it over to a laundering service. They weren't doing their own laundering, and that laundering service held onto it too long, and then it depreciated by that much. Then there'd probably be some raised voices, I'm guessing. All right. So our first article is verified Twitter accounts phished via hate speech warnings. This comes to us from Malwarebytes. So what's going on is compromised accounts are being used to look like member support teams and are DMing verified accounts. Yeah, so all the normies out there are safe. It's just the blue check marks that are in trouble, I guess.
Thank goodness, I'm safe.
So here's what the DM that's being sent to these folks says. It says, "Hey, your account has been flagged as inauthentic and unsafe by our automated system. Spreading hate speech is against our terms of service. We at Twitter take the security of our platform very seriously. That's why we're suspending your account in 48 hours if you do not complete the authentication process to authenticate your account. Follow the link below." And if you notice, I know my English is usually bad, but if you notice, they did have a typo in there where they said "why were r" instead of eliminating the r and putting an apostrophe there and saying "were" as in "we are," or getting rid of the er and saying "we are." So like any phishing scam, you know, look for those typos. But beat into our heads forever in phishing training. But I thought it was kind of amusing that this is kind of geared toward a certain kind of person, because it says it's been flagged as inauthentic and unsafe. I was like, oh my God, inauthentic. I can't possibly be labeled inauthentic. What am I going to do?
You know what though?
What do my friends think?
You know, you put in here that it's only targeting blue check marks. And that's kind of interesting though, because people that have larger accounts probably have a lot more latent fear of that being flagged as inauthentic or unsafe, simply because I mean anybody who has a big social media presence gets a lot of just negative jizz and, you know, people reporting them all the time. This is probably like a real live fear for them, whereas me with my Twitter account that I do almost nothing with have still even a little bit of fear about somebody coming out of the woodwork and reporting my shit. But
so you're saying because of reputational damage equals financial damage, this is a big concern
for versus most normal people who'd be like, huh, whatever, and just keep going on.
Yeah, so it kind of seems like they're accusing them of being a bot. You're inauthentic.
Yeah, it does sound kind of like that. And I think especially nowadays when all this Twitter discussions are going on, when Elon just tried to buy Twitter and Twitter was saying only 5% of their accounts were bots, and now there's accusations going around that up to 90% of the accounts on Twitter are bots.
Elon actually said 90%, because that's like ridiculously high.
I don't know. I'm actually looking that up. I'm gonna May 15th, 2022. Wow. Elon Musk speculates that over 90% of Twitter's daily active users might be bots. So I guess not 90% of all the users, 90% of the daily users, which does make sense. I mean, my account, I don't necessarily use it every single day.
So what would that number be on a daily average then? What's the daily average number of users on Twitter? Does it say?
I said 229 million monetizable daily users in Q1 2023. So that means that he's saying there's only, 45 million that are, 23 million that are people. Interesting.
Yeah, well, if you're looking at an ad-based revenue based on what impressions or whatever you want to call it, that'd mean that you're if you're paying for that, you're getting ripped off as an advertiser because you're only getting really 1 or 10% of the impressions you think you're getting.
I think that's true of almost all ads. I think a lot of ads are like that, given how much ad-related malware we see.
What do you mean, that the advertisers are getting ripped off because they're overpaying for the impressions? Yes.
Yeah.
Don't we see fraud tons, or whatever?
Yeah. Tons and tons of ad-related farms and click farms and stuff like that. There's a Bloomberg article speculating Bot Sentinel. The research firm Bot Sentinel estimates that 10 to 15% accounts on Twitter are inauthentic. So it varies widely.
Remember, advertisers are actually completely oblivious to this, or they know it and they simply build that in, and yet these companies are still able to make a ton of money on ads, even though they know that they're not getting the impressions that they claim they're getting.
I think it's two things. I think number one, they build it in. And number two, I think nobody's really been able to measure ad spend as well as they want to. Sure, we're getting better at it online because you can measure like click through and stuff from Twitter. But I know in a lot of ad stuff, you're never able to really measure. You're never able to measure ad spending on like, you know, video ads on TV and stuff. But maybe on Twitter you can. On Twitter you can, you know, see how many people click through to your website and how many people buy.
The one thing that tips off this whole thing though is, when has Twitter ever warned anybody before banning them instead of just banning them outright?
I've never been banned on Twitter, so I don't know.
Twitter doesn't warn anybody. They just ban them. You're banned. No soup for you. And that's it. They never say, we're going to ban you. They just ban you outright. So that should have been an indicator right there. Said, oh, we're going to ban you in 48 hours. And of course, the link that they put in there is from a link shortener, which I think would have been also an indicator that that was not legit. But the link goes to what is titled the Twitter Help Center. It's actually connecting into the Twitter API to pull up the target's Twitter account name. And then it asks for their password and gives them a welcome back message along with an image that they pulled from the victim's account to show their profile picture. Which gives them a warm and fuzzy that it's all been legit and everything, which I think is pretty slick. And then ask them to verify their email address, which they also then double check using the Twitter API to make sure that that's accurate. And then it gives them the final pop-up that says, hey, you're authentic, you're good to go now. And at which point they've now have everything they need to take over the account.
No, and that's really nice too, because like you said, that's like the welcome back picture. And by checking everything, they have given the user the warm and fuzzies. So now the user just proceeds on and thinks that everything is good, and they don't report anything and they don't change their password because everything seems to be hunky-dory.
Right. It's really good way to obfuscate that. It's pretty slick.
Yeah, because a lot of times when it's the fake email login or whatever, and they try to log in and it'll give them the error message or something, or it logs them in or fake logs them in and then redirects them somewhere, the user's like, huh, that's weird. And right. Then they may contact somebody to say something weird happened. But in this case, it's transparent to them.
Yeah. And this goes to what we've been talking about this whole time about, you know, these guys are only getting more sophisticated, you know, with the exception of that typo, which really they need a QA department or something.
I'm happy to help them out for the low, low price of $1,000 per.
Yeah, I noticed that you're not asking for crypto coin anymore. Yeah, don't pay me in crypto.
Actually, you know, it probably should. It's probably at or near the low.
I don't think so, but we'll see.
Think we're going to hit 10,000?
I certainly hope so.
You're like still DCAing in.
But, you know, I think once it hits a certain point, though, institutional investors are going to have to dump. And when that happens, that's going to cause a total collapse. Because you're talking about institutional investors that they're talking billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars that they've invested in these coins. And once it reaches a certain point, they're like, this is unsustainable. We got to get rid of this and move our investment money.
Yeah. So, what's that?
But anyway, so, you know, why does this matter? It was like, if you have a Twitter account that you're concerned about people taking over, you certainly should be aware of this kind of scam. And, you know, treat any warning messages that you get from them to be kind of suspect. And you're better off, rather than clicking that link, going to the support center that you know the URL for and logging in and then looking at your account that way to see if there's any issues.
Seems good. Second article is crypto-based, yay, but also security-based. Crypto sleuths spend the $100 million Harmony theft on Lazarus Group. It's the North Koreans. Oh no. This article comes to us from The Register, one of our favorite sources. The other week, there was $100 million in crypto stolen from Harmony's Horizon Bridge. The company has not officially revealed how it occurred at this point in time that I've seen, but we have some more info on where the crypto is going and potentially who took it. So discussion points. What is a bridge? A bridge is a method of transferring assets between blockchains. Without a bridge, you can transfer assets to other people on the blockchain, but that makes it somewhat difficult to get assets off the blockchain and do some other type of asset, such as, I don't know, cash or Bitcoin or Ethereum or something like that. These types of attacks are growing more common. We talked a couple months ago about Axie Infinity, Ronin Bridge. I think that was $625 million.
Yeah, which is almost the same amount that Hans Gruber was looking to steal from Nakatomi. That was $640 million. You know, which in 1988, $640 million today, that is $1.5 billion they were planning to steal in that heist.
At least that went in the right direction with inflation.
Well, not really. It went the opposite direction. Because if you stole $640 million and you held on to it today,
it would be worth
way less than $640 million because it depreciates with time.
If they would need $1.5 billion to have the equivalent purchasing power.
Correct.
Yep, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yep. So actually, it's kind of the same as crypto because right now they've held on to that $620 million. They now have $220 million in crypto. That happened a lot faster, though.
Yeah. So that's that's over a 50% loss.
That's fair. Same with the crypto. Just one happened in 30 years and the other happened in 3 months.
That's a good point. Much more rapid decline.
Yep. There's another one called the Wormhole Bridge that was hacked recently for $320 million. So altogether, the three of those hacks alone is $1 billion over the last year.
Yeah. And coincidentally, you know, Roger Grimes from the company KnowBefore is quoted as saying, "With traditional finance, if someone steals something of value, it's fairly easy to identify the theft and then reverse the transaction." You know, which is why, you know, in certain BEC cases, they're able to recover some of that. Where in the case of crypto, once you do that transfer, forget about it. And he goes on to say, cryptocurrencies are more like bearer bonds. The holder of the bearer bonds is the lawful owner of the bonds and their associated value, even if they were stolen. Which harkened back to our, which we talked about just a second ago, because that was $640 million in negotiable bearer bonds.
So that's interesting. I think we've talked about this before, but does that mean that there's a market for like a escrow companies that would hold the crypto for 24 hours for large transactions and where you can set up the blockchain with a smart contract to force transactions over a certain value to go through these escrow companies? I totally get that kind of destroys some of the value, basic value of cryptocurrency.
It's possible if they could do that forcing to there.
You'd almost have to force it with smart contracts, though, because what good is having, you know, oh, well, we promise that we'll send all this stuff through you. And then somebody, you know, breaks the multi-sig and then they just send it wherever they want to anyways. Like you would actually have to enforce it somehow. But
right. Hmm. Which would mean if you're going to pull off a theft of this level in the future, you'd have to be able to compromise it in two ways. One, just to get at it. And two, to get around the smart contract.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, you'd almost have to, you'd have to put like a threshold in the contract, like under 100 coins or whatever, or under $100,000, you know, do what you want, like send it however you want, no tracking or anything like that. But over this much, there's extra protection, maybe. I wonder if I don't know. Interesting thought.
Anyway, we're going to see something like, somebody's going to figure this out, I think.
Yeah, I'm almost certain that someone right now is working on trying to make a end quote blockchain to try and prevent these kinds of things.
Or a recoverable dispersal method or something like that.
Which then I'm sure some hackers will figure out how to take advantage of that. And then there'll be a different kind of scam where they, you know, oh, you know, we'll do it in escrow and it's completely safe. And then they yank the money back after the transaction.
Right. I mean, securities, I mean, this has always kind of been an arms race, you know, between attackers and defenders, where, you know, attackers will come up with some novel way to steal, and then defenders will find a way to prevent that novel method. And then the attackers will come up with a new novel method. And, you know, as it, you know, it continues to go on. So in the meantime, there'll be money to be made in people working on figuring out this problem.
Yep. Always will be.
On both sides.
So Horizon Bridge was audited in 2020. They found multiple vulns, all of which were remediated. The Horizon Bridge announced a bounty. They said the hackers could return the crypto assets anonymously by July 4th and keep $10 million. Or alternatively, they would give $10 million to someone who gave them information that led to the funds being returned and the hackers being arrested.
Right. So, you know, this makes me think that either the hackers are, you know, actually North Korean state sponsored, like people believe, or whoever these hackers are, they're completely dismissive of the possibility of being caught. otherwise, $10 million, that's a pretty good payday, I would think. I mean, maybe I'm just lowballing it, but, you know, I would think that's a pretty good payday to get $10 million and not have to look over your shoulder anymore. Your cop's not coming for you, you know, and nobody else is coming for you either. Well, at least the cops are not coming for you, considering that the company is saying, oh, well, we'll just let you keep $10 million.
Yeah.
That seems like a good deal to me.
Well, what's interesting too is last year, the Poly network was hit by a major attack where the hacker stole more than $600 million. And the hacker returned most of it. They kept $33 million? No. Oh, they kept $500,000. And then there was, in June this year, hacker returned $15 million to Optimism. They stole $16 million in funds and they returned $15 million. So it's not completely unheard of for some of these hackers to return the majority of the funds.
That's interesting because you don't hear about that.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. I feel like we would have talked about that if that had come across our desk. That would have made an interesting discussion article.
You know, that's funny because, you know, this just got me thinking. Have you ever heard of The Brinks Job?
No.
It was a Peter Falk movie in 78 based on an actual heist that took place where they stole $100,000 from a Brinks armored car. And the movie was in 78. The actual theft, I think, occurred in the 50s. But that was famous, made headlines enough for them to make a movie about it. It was only $100,000. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars today are being stolen several times a year now. It's just crazy the amount of funds that are being stolen in one go today.
Yeah. And we were talking the other day about bank robbers make out with an average of what, $10,000. And that's just like the dumbest crime ever. you don't even make enough money for like a month's salary at an upper middle class lifestyle.
And you could get shot.
And you do this and you have almost no chance of getting shot. You have very low chance of getting caught at all. Although of course, cashing out's a problem, but.
Yeah, but apparently if you steal enough, they're willing to trade.
Yeah. Yeah. You steal $100 million and you give back 90 of it for the $10 million payday. I mean, that sounds pretty good.
Right. And you may be even, I mean, at this point, you might even be able to make that offer. You steal $100 million and then just note them, message them and say, hey, we'll give you 90 of it back if you just leave us alone.
Yep.
I mean, and I think a lot of companies would be hard pressed not to take them up on that offer considering, you know, what we're talking about here with the likelihood of being able to recoup any of that is virtually zero.
And $10 million, you stick $10 million in the stock market and you live off the proceeds at 3% a year. And that's $300,000 a year. That is a very nice, very upper middle class income.
Not that we're condoning this, of course. Theft is wrong. Okay. Just want to get on the record. But all this was figured out by a blockchain company called, or blockchain analytics company called Elliptic. And, you know, just this whole idea of a blockchain analytics company got me thinking about how do these guys make money? Do they only work for the cops and spy agencies? Or is there a market for these types of analytical chains or analytical companies outside of the government?
Well, you'll notice that later in the article that's linked off of it, they suggest that the exchanges should buy and use their software to watch for and detect if incoming funds come from the hacked bridges. So they managed to slip a little business development into this article.
Okay. I didn't read the article as closely as I thought then. I don't remember reading that.
I went back and I found the original article that a register used to work off of this. But yeah, it was mentioned in both. It was a blog article from elliptic.co. Mentioned in there.
Okay. So there is some kind of method for these guys to make money outside the government. That's good. Because you see these companies all the time. I think just reading these articles over the past couple of days, I think there's like three or four different ones that I read about in those articles alone.
Yeah, there's Chainalysis is the big one that seems to be. Yeah, they're everywhere.
So the attackers used Tornado Cash to try to hide the cash, and they moved 35,000 Ether through, but Elliptic claimed they had this special secret sauce where they were able to actually track that money, which means that they moved, what was that, like 39 million, I think is what 35 Ether come out to approximately.
I don't even know anymore. I'm trying not to look. I don't want to know.
But at the time the article was written, I believe it was 39 million. Ether's been holding relatively steady the past week or so at around 1,100, I think. But something else that wasn't in this article, but we discovered recently, since we're talking about Axie Infinity, is the way that Axie Infinity was compromised was pretty interesting. We thought we should bring it to folks' attention. So there was an engineer at Axie Infinity that was contacted over LinkedIn about a potential job offer. And this engineer went through multiple rounds of job interviews based on this contact via LinkedIn. And then they received an extremely generous compensation package via PDF sent to this engineer's work computer. And when he opened it, that PDF compromised his machine. And that's how they got into the network at Sky Mavis, which owns the Axie Infinity.
As a side note, I got a recruiter reached out to me last week on LinkedIn and sent me a document file with a job description. I'm not opening that sucker. Absolutely not. Nope.
I mean, well, what? This guy should not have been doing this job hunting on his work computer anyway.
That's fair. Well, actually, I guess I may open it if the job offer is very generous compensation.
Yeah. Well, at least open it on your work computer so your personal computer doesn't get compromised. I'm sorry. I should, again, caveat that with I do not condone that action. Take that document, run it to a sandbox, verify it's good, you know, and then open it on your personal computer. But after all this shenanigans, they did reopen the Ronin Bridge last week.
Did you see the list? I think the article had a list of how Axie Infinity's transactions had dropped.
I didn't recall seeing that. It may have been in there, but I don't recall.
So it looks like when the hack actually occurred, Axie Infinity was already in a pretty steep decline, and they've been flatlining for the last couple months. So they have not doing well in terms of the number of transactions that have been occurring. So it's not in that article. It must have been a different article that I saw.
It accelerated their decline.
No, it actually happened. I wish I could find that article. It happened kind of at the bottom. It looked like Axie Infinity had mostly flatlined low. The soft love potion, or whatever the name of that love potion was not worth very much. And they had cut the number you could get per day. And a lot of people were unhappy because you couldn't make a living anymore off of it. Or at least not much as much of a living. So it was really struggling at the time. Anyways, that's unrelated to the hack.
Yeah, and if you recall when we talked about this hack, what had happened was the hackers need to control a number of node validation nodes in order to be able to transfer that money out. So they needed 5 of 9 and they compromised 4 of the 9, and then they were able to hack into the Axie DAO, which is a decentralized autonomous organization.
7 of 9.
A lot of people like to hack into 7 of 9 though. So they set up this DAO to support their gaming system in November of 2021, but they stopped using it in December of 2021, but they failed to remove that DAO's access. And I think we may have talked about at the time saying, well, if they increase the number of validator nodes to a huge amount, then that would greatly reduce the likelihood of this same type of attack being able to be successful. And they seem to be going down that path in order to prevent this in the future. So they expanded the number of validated nodes from 9 to 11 today. And their long-term goal is to expand it to more than 100.
A million nodes. So Elliptic said that the Lazarus Group appeared to be behind the attack. And the article itself, the Register article, didn't have any information other than just believe me. But if you went back to the blog article that was behind the Register article, which is linked in the show notes, their supposition, I thought, was pretty weak.
I agree.
It was based on the fact that the Lazarus Group has targeted decentralized finance and bridges in the past, and the possible techniques that have not yet been confirmed, but were hypothesized at match what has been used by them in the past. The hypothesized technique was that it was a compromise of a multi-sig wallet and probably through social engineering, but again, has not been confirmed, just hypothesized.
You're missing here, though, Matt, is they're the only ones that could possibly do that kind of thing.
That's an APT. It's a nation state level hack.
Yeah, so it's impossible for anybody else to initiate those kinds of attacks.
You're right. My bad. I missed that. It was an APAC target, and the funds were moved out of APAC, were moved out of Tornado Cash during APAC nighttime hours. So they're the only group that works in APAC time zone. So
yeah, it's not like, you know, someone on a 12-hour schedule away from that would do that during the day.
Not all.
So the gist of what we're saying is that their reasoning here is really thin.
Real thin.
I'm not saying that it's not true, but their reasoning is pretty thin. So, you know, and this is one of those things that whenever you run into one of these issues where it seems like there's a problem with cryptography, it's not cryptography. It's the implementation of the cryptography that is actually the weak point. And that's what you're seeing with these bridges. You know, so the endpoint, you have endpoint copy paste or keyloggers or whatever. That's kind of like the mugger on the street getting away with a couple of bucks. But when they break into these bridges or exchanges, well, that's really where that's like attacking a bank. That's where they go to steal real money. So that's why you're seeing the rise on this, or the rise of these types of attacks. Now, what they suggested as a way to combat this is, quote, increased regulation and oversight will likely be required because the number of people participating won't grow significantly as long as they get robbed without recourse. And this seemed to be a stretch for me. The idea that, you know, without government regulation, no one will be willing to take the risk on this, when obviously millions of people already are doing this. And Matt and I talked just a second ago about, you know, other ways that this could that you could build in safeguards for this. I don't think you need government regulation for that. People don't need their handheld to do this kind of thing. And this is an example of how the government actually hurts the market by crowding out private actors. You know, if the government comes up with regulations and oversight and all these shenanigans in order to try to prevent these kinds of actions from taking place, then that crowds out the entrepreneur out there that's looking at this and saying, hey, I know of a way that we can make this more improve the safety of this, or improve the user confidence in these types of transactions. You know, if people think and expect the government to fix this kind of theft, then it's discouraging the market from coming up with services to do this kind of thing. And that you've actually seen this in the past, although most people don't realize it, is that this is the same kind of thing when they invented the FDIC. So before the FDIC, when banks failed to provide funds back to people, you would have bank runs, and the bank would then collapse because they were not actually being proper stewards of people's money. So back before the FDIC, people would actually do some due diligence on the banks where they would put their money, because in the event that bank was not honest, then that would increase the likelihood that they would actually lose their money that was in the bank should that bank collapse. So today, rather than doing what people used to do before with the analog vetting of banks, people have to do the technical vetting of these exchanges. And people are going to be looking for, or should be looking for in the future, like the Harmony Bridge thing where they did a vulnerability assessment, and you have stuff equivalent to like the SOC 2 and those kinds of reports or those kind of audits against these places in order for people to have some level of assurance that the banks or the exchanges and the bridges are properly securing their money. And just having the government step in is going to do nothing but obfuscate the problem and not actually fix anything.
Yeah, this would be interesting. It'd be interesting if to see if the other, I'd like to see if some of the DeFi exchanges can start to learn a lesson, but I don't know. We keep seeing these bridges and these exchanges get hit. I feel like they haven't learned the lessons that banks have already learned, that banks learned back in the 90s. And maybe it's because it's all entrepreneurs that don't have that history from being in the finance. It's all, you know, young programmers that don't have that background in finance and don't have that background in computer security. And maybe move fast and break things might not be the best philosophy when there's hundreds of millions of dollars in easily transferable assets that can't be clawed back.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of arrogance there too, because banks are considered old and crotchety. You know, they don't think that the younger crowd or that are developing these things don't think they need to understand or learn from the experiences of those organizations in the past, because they're doing things the new way.
Yeah.
But our last article is human error blamed for the leak of 1 billion records of Chinese citizens. And this comes to us from ThreatPost.
Are there even that many people in the world?
Yeah, there are more than 1 billion people in the world.
Slightly. But I thought, didn't the Georgia Stone tell us to keep it under 500 million? I can't believe we didn't follow that.
Well, that's why the Georgia Guidestones got blown up, because it was wrong. So apparently, a developer has divulged the credentials to a police database on a popular development forum, leading to the breach and subsequent selling, or the bid to sell, 23 terabytes of personal data on the dark web. So a developer wrote a blog post on the China Software Development Network, the CSDN, that accidentally included credentials to the system where the data was stored. And this 23 terabytes included the names, addresses, birthplaces, national IDs, phone numbers, and critical case information of 1 billion Chinese citizens. I was like, no social credit score? I mean, what the hell's going on? They didn't get the full data set.
That actually would have been really interesting. I would love to see the raw information behind the social credit score. And I would love to see people like reverse engineer it. Have we seen that data? Has it ever been revealed?
No. And I've actually heard a couple of different people refute that that's even really going on, including from this individual in America living in Shanghai that says they don't see that kind of social credit score thing going on. So there's not uniformity that's an actual thing. And I'm not saying that it's not. That certainly makes sense based on what we've heard that it's true, but I certainly am not completely sold that it's definitely happening.
Interesting.
But you can imagine that the guy that broke into the database and realized he had to get out 23 terabytes, you know, what he was, you know, if he was prepared for that when it happened.
Yeah. What do you do if you're like, if you break in and you think you found something cool and you start downloading it and it just keeps downloading, keeps going? Do you know ahead of time when you're looking? I guess you can know if it's all in one place. I guess I'm not as familiar with databases as I should be. Is there an easy way to tell if a database, how big a database file is before you start pulling the information? How big a table is?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about SQL to know if there's a way to really.
You could get a record count.
Yeah.
And maybe you pull down one record and use that to average out the data size, you know, what your expectations would be.
But do you always do that, or just like, how big could it be? I'm just going to start pulling this.
Well, I think at some point though, if you break in, you're going to want to see exactly how much you've got access to. So you probably do a record count. And then when you see it come back as 1 billion, I think right there, you'd be like, okay, that's probably a lot of data.
Yeah. No doubt you're not pulling it down to your local system because you don't want to point the arrow right back to you. You've got an intermediary system you're bringing it back to in the middle somewhere.
Right.
So you're checking all your compromised boxes to see, all right, who's got the most storage?
I doubt if you've got a compromised box that's got 23 terabytes. Terabytes.
Yeah. You're like, all right, how many stolen credit cards do I have? I got to stand up some ADA. I got to get an ADA and S3 bucket. I got to get 23 terabytes of.
I mean, that would have to be the way they'd go. They'd have to get a cloud storage to ship that to you. There's no way that they would be able to have that kind of local source somewhere. Well, I'm not going to say no way. It's highly unlikely that they would be have control over a system that had 23 terabytes of local storage. And even if they did, once they started filling up that storage, whoever actually owns that system would probably notice that.
I was just thinking, like, you show up on Monday, they're like, hey guys, we found this giant file that ate up all of our file system.
Well, I can tell you, you know, when I worked for them, there was a rampant problem with anonymous FTP. And back at that time, you know, it was a much simpler time. So most of the time, it was simply used for wares. Mm. But that was frequently the way that this was discovered, that anonymous FTP server was being misused for wares, is that it would run out of space. And then the administrator would start looking into it, and then they would contact us and say, yeah, we think we've been compromised because all this data that's being stored here now. So that would be certainly one way to end up tipping your hand, which is why it's most likely that once they realized this, they would end up getting some kind of cloud storage, probably purchased with a stored credit card or something, where they could throw that data out to.
And I think we did some quick back of the envelope calculation. It was only like $500 or something, $400 to store it. Yes.
Right. Well, it was $500 to store it, but I think, didn't we figure out
like
it would be $2,000 to get it out? So you could store it for $500, but if you wanted to transfer it out of that AWS, it would cost you something like $2,000 to transfer it out.
It was a lot.
And I can't remember if the article, I don't have it in my notes here, about what they were trying to sell it for. I think it was like $200,000.
Yep. Yeah, it was like 200 ETH. Or no, it was Bitcoin, wasn't it? It was like 20 Bitcoin or no, 10 Bitcoin.
Yeah. So fairly large amount, but not huge. And what's also interesting about this is this was stolen from the Shanghai Police Department database. Now, first off, just to note, Shanghai is 6,000 years old, which just blows my mind. Well, that's kind of here and there. But Shanghai only has a population of 28 million, and yet they have the records of 1 billion people. So does that mean that all police departments have all the records from all the other police departments on the entire population of China? Or is it just like the large police organizations or police departments that have the database for all the Chinese? Because the current population of China is 1.4 billion. And if you figure, you know, 0.4 billion or 400 million have not interacted with the police, then, you know, that would be reasonable to think that that's where the billion comes from to make the entire population that would be in this database to be in the database.
You know, that does make sense, especially if you assume the social credit score is at least a future state. They would need to have that information in case people travel there. Probably makes more sense, your hypothesis, that at least the big cities have to have all that information in case somebody shows up on their, you know, CCTV or they get picked up. How else are you going to, you know, get their social credit score if you don't have their information?
Well, it also builds a bit of resiliency into the infrastructure then, because you've got decentralized storage of the 1 billion records.
Mm.
So, you know, if every police department has all the billion records, then any one police department or one central location doesn't have to ensure the resiliency of the data because it's already in multiple places.
Could see that too.
All right. And actually, now that I think about it, it would have to be the larger police departments, because the smaller ones are not going to have the ability to store 23 terabytes of data for individuals that they most likely are not going to interact with. But the human error element that harkens back to the DBIR, which we just talked about last week, where the human element is 82% of breaches and 13% of those being directly attributed to human error. But if you really think about it, aren't 100% of breaches due to human error? You know, developers, so. Administrators, users, it's always someone's fault.
True that.
Or dear mother.
It's all her fault.
Yeah, I blame her every day. All right. And so this is not the first time we've seen this kind of problem either. And, you know, developers, when they run into problems, they go to the internet to try to find out if someone else has already solved this problem that they're working through. And often they will post code to provide an example or demonstrate the problem that they're experiencing so other developers can look at it and provide them some guidance on the issue that they're running into. So this is not really an outlier in the fact that developers post code. But the problem is that code had the hard-coded credentials in there for the database. And hard-coded credentials in source code is a no-no. That really should not be done.
Well, I'm going to have to go change all my passwords. Damn it.
Yeah, you should be storing these things in a password manager that allows the code to pull the credentials into it at the time of execution. So there are several platforms that are out there that do that, like CyberArk, Thycotic Secret Server, and HashiVault, that allow you to put code snippets into your code, which will then interact with your password vault in order to retrieve those credentials at the time they need to be executed.
What do you think happened to the person who hard-coded it? I mean, in the US, they'd probably be fired. What happens to somebody in China?
Well, I would say they were definitely fired. I don't know. I don't like to speculate too much on that kind of thing, because I have no frame of reference for the way the Chinese justice system works. Hopefully being fired is the worst thing that happened to that guy. But also, considering he was a government stooge at the time he did this, I don't know. But yeah, hopefully being fired is the worst thing that happened to the guy.
Yeah, could have been worse. Could have been working for a Russian gang. Can you imagine if one of them had left their hard-coded credentials in the malware they pushed out?
No, you're waking up in a ditch. Or you're not waking up in a ditch. However you want to put that. Another thing that they didn't mention in the article about the problem here, they harp a lot on the hard-coded credentials. But they didn't mention at all that apparently the database was accessible from the internet, which is also not a great idea. Neither did they mention that you might want to be monitoring your data transmission volumes with NetFlow or something else, because the exfil of 23 terabytes of data really probably should have been noticeable.
Yeah, that should have triggered an alert of some.
Because that's crazy, crazy big. So in the future, those three things would be the takeaway. You use a password vault to interact with your code. Don't allow your databases to be regularly accessed from the internet. And have some monitoring in place for data transmission volumes at your edge.
And I don't think, and again, like, you don't need to be watching for small spikes. Like, this should have been a huge spike that, like 3-4 times the normal, what's the statistics word for it?
What, deviation?
Yeah, like standard deviation. Like, this should not have been, you can have an alert tuned for this that would be pretty loosely tuned and shouldn't generate many false positives, and should have still been like, holy crap, look at this, somebody look at this.
So, and even if you were, and if to do this even better, you might want to do that average on a, or have a couple of alerts over rolling averages. What's the average for the day look like? What's the average for the week look like? And what's the average for the month look like? If any one of those is more than one or two standard deviation from norm, then you've triggered an alert and you start investigating that.
Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.